This is Jim Inkster. Coming next, the legendary political consultant Gus Weil. We'll talk about things close by and far away with Gus Weil, who, of course, was a mentor to the likes of James Carville and Raymond Strother and Roy Fletcher. He'll have much to say about Governor Jindal and Mary Landrieu and what's happening in the political realm as we speak. Also on the show, Channing Chase, actress from Mad Men, on her role in one of the most enduring and successful dramas in the history of television. And we'll visit with Baton Rouge attorney Haney Zodi about the upheaval in his homeland of Egypt. Unfortunate developments this morning with reports that as many as 50 people have been killed in Cairo. We'll talk about it. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with the legendary and fabled political consultant Gus Weil, a man who has been around the political block since 1958, graduate of Louisiana State University, a member of the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame and the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame, and a former U.S. Special Forces guy. He was in the Counterintelligence Corps. Good morning, Lieutenant Gus Weil.
Good morning, Jim.
And Gus, I love talking about your past. Nobody has a past as varied as you. Some of the books written by this man, by the way, The Cajuns, Flesh, The Fuhrer's Seed, Love and Other Guilts, Paradiddle, The Wild Side of Louisiana Politics, and my personal favorite, A Woman's Eyes. Gus, you're a busy man as we speak.
Certainly I was. I'm not as busy now. Now I'm kind of spending a great deal of time, as most older people do, summing it all up and thinking about it and shaking my head over the mistakes and errors that I made and celebrating the occasional victories.
Well, as I stated, you've been around the political block since 1958, the year that LSU had its only undefeated football season in modern time, and you've been the mentor to the likes of James Carville, Roy Fletcher, Raymond Strother. They all worked for Gus Weil, and Gus, of course, has worked for a few governors, in particular John McKithen. We have a governor now who's in his second term. Our president is in his second term. How do second terms differ from first terms?
Second terms definitely differ. First, people who would like to fall out with you have the courage to do so because you're not going to be around that, you know, much longer. In other words, your enemies are not facing another 4 years. And so that's one of the big changes. Also, your constituency, the politics, the body politic, is used to you and perhaps even a little bored with you or angry with you or mystified by you. And so You lose your allure. It's like too many dates with the same woman. The mystery is no longer there.
quite an analogy from Gus Weil. Too many dates with the same woman. Is that what we've had with Governor Jindal and President Obama?
I think that it's been, well, I don't know so much about Obama, though he is certainly suffering from a second term shock. But Jindal, I think from what I can read and see on television and the radio, that's absolutely the case. His flaws have caught up with him.
Well, it was two weeks ago now, he wrote a screed in Politico, an essay that was full of red meat for conservatives, telling his fellow Republicans to, quote, put on their big boy pants, to stop the bedwetting, stop the navel gazing, and start kicking around the other guys. Those are the direct quotes from our governor. And there are some who said that Bobby Jindal, a Rhodes Scholar, graduate of Brown University, would not have written such a piece. Do you think he wrote those words?
I think that he is being counseled by a political like-minded people and feels that he has a long chance at running and for the presidency and getting the Republican nomination, and I'm sure that that colors his every waking moment because that's heady. That'll drive a man crazy thinking that there's a possibility that every time he comes on the scene, the band strikes up "Hail to the Chief."
Well, when you were serving governors, did you occasionally write speeches for them that they put their name on?
I did all the time. That's really how I got close to John McKithen. When he was elected, I worked for him as his executive secretary, but he wasn't particularly enamored of me and whatever talent I might have possessed. And once he called me and at the office and said, "Gus, come on, I've got to give a speech in New Orleans. You can ride with me." So I guess it was just to kill, have company. So I got in the limousine in the back with him in a jump seat, and we got to New Orleans. And I said, "What are you going for?" He said, "So help me, I don't even remember, because the governor's schedule is very, very heavy." And it turned out to be for the, we got there, and he said, he called me on the side and said, "Mr. Weil," he said, I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Do you know what this is?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "I'm to speak on the Battle of New Orleans." And he said, "And Russell Long is on the program, too." And Russell Long was a United States Senator, son of the late Huey Long, and a man who McKithen, I think, aspired to compete with. Because even though he was governor, McKithen was, Russell Long was still the man. Louisiana was always his state. So he said, "What in the hell am I going to say?" He said, "You know, I don't know anything about the Battle of New Orleans." And I looked up like seeking divine intercession. And I said, "Well, let me quick go find out, you know, try and come up with something." And I had no pencil. I showed you how well prepared I was. No paper. So I got a menu from the Blue Room and a pencil I bought from a waiter, and I scribbled down some remarks that he might make. It was all highly poetic and beautiful. It had no facts because neither I nor him possessed them. And so he got up, and he was desperate, and so he started reading that menu, what I had written. And he got a standing ovation.
Reading off the menu.
Yeah, my speech. Lucky he didn't read the menu, you know.
At the Blue Room.
Yeah, lobster. my fellow lobsters. And so when it was over and he had been lauded and applauded by the audience and had obviously beaten up Russell Long, he told me as we were got in the back of that limousine, he said, "I will never leave you out of my sight again." I said, "Oh, I thought that's fine." He said, "That speech kind of saved the day." At any rate, I thought he was joking, but he never really let me get too far after that.
So speechwriters, believe it or not, actually write things for governors that governors take credit for. You're kidding me.
Yes, and it's a good thing. It's proper. For example, a man like Obama, when in the name of Hades would he have time to write a speech? His plate is so full of appointments and going to comfort somebody, some village or town that's been hurt terribly by national trauma. So he's got to have somebody who's writing speeches. In the case of the president, I'm sure he's got 10 or 12 speechwriters. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm sure each of them has a different specialty. For example, a president needs a good gag writer, somebody who can write funny things, because every speech, unless it's something having to do with death, every speech opens with some little gentle humor. And then when he talks to the correspondents at the annual dinner, he needs a whole 30 minutes of gags, so I'm sure he's got a professional gag writer, somebody who wrote for David Letterman,
right,
something like that.
Well, with Bobby Jindal, he rarely has a laugh line at the start of his speech. And in this essay to Politico, most speechwriters, Gus, secretly aspire to be the next Ted Sorensen or the next Gus Weill.
That's right.
They tend to write in lofty terms.
Yes.
And use flowery language. They don't generally tell people to put on their big boy pants and stop the bedwetting.
Sounds terribly cliched. And it's also, just from a professional standpoint, embarrassingly written. In other words, whoever wrote those lines, and I had not heard them prior to your reciting them to me today, put on your big boy pants and that kind of stuff, I, in my worst moments, and I had some bad moments, would not have written drivel like that.
That's why I think, and believe me, the governor is far smarter than I am, but I don't know that he's a very good speech writer. That's why I think he may have actually written this, because not many speech writers would write something like that.
I cannot imagine it either. And you know, when you get off something like that, put on your big boy pants and so on, if you have that type of mind that you conceive of something like that, and the inane courage to present it, you must feel like you really accomplished something. You know, In fact, I saw Jindal fail in the most terrible way possible. As you know, when the president gives a State of the Union speech, which he must give by law once a year, a member of the opposite party is allowed to give a speech on radio nationwide, and it always has a huge audience. And I remember when Jindal was really being talked about for the presidency, and he was chosen by the Republican National Committee to give the speech after the president's speech. And so I watched it. It was on television, and it was embarrassing. It was just so schoolboy. It was somebody who didn't know anything about life or had any empathy for the humanity. And he gave that. And incidentally, I think from that moment on, his decline began. Now, sometimes a governor, a president, doesn't have a real top speechwriter because his ego won't allow it. He's not only the best in this or that, he's the best speechwriter.
Yeah. Well, you recall one year, Bill Clinton, when he was delivering the State of the Union address, Gus, they loaded the speech from the year before. So as he was looking in the teleprompter, he had the preceding year's State of the Union address, and he had to do it on the fly.
And, oh, goodness, I forgot that.
And he pulled it off. There aren't many who could do that.
No, John McKiffin, of course, was so fluent and had such mental capacity that he could do it effortlessly. I think what was so difficult about writing for him, and we're talking about speech writing now, I had no access to North Louisiana prior to running into him. By having no access, I mean I had no sense of their lingo, their intonation, their language skills. And I realized I better, if I was going to be writing for this man, I'd better start listening to him. And I did, and towards about 3 months into his term, I was able to pretty much sound like John McKiffin in my use of language, metaphor, and so on.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Gus Weill with us for a bit longer, and we'll talk with him about the governor's 64-parish tour, whether Bobby Jindal will be running for president in 2016 or U.S. Senate in 2014, and about Mary Landrieu's tough election next year, whether it's against Bill Cassidy or Bobby Jindal or some unknown or unannounced candidate. What will happen come next year as Mary Landrieu is the last Democrat standing in statewide politics in Louisiana as far as elected officials? Inkster Show at WRKF.org as well, if you'd like to reach us online. J.C. Kane producing, and we shall return in 90 seconds with Gus Weill. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number. Gus Weil with us, the legendary political consultant, Veronica in Denham Springs. Veronica, good morning. You're on the air with Gus.
Hi. I am not a gentle supporter, but with that being said, is it possible that he's a victim of expectations? For instance, President Bush's speeches often lacked everything, and we didn't give him nearly the scrutiny that we give Bobby Jindal. Maybe we expect more of someone who's capable of giving better performances. Thanks.
All right.
Where was that question?
Veronica says that we may be too tough on the governor as far as his speech-making ability because there have been others. So as she said, President Bush as an example, who didn't give great speeches and didn't get the kind of criticism that Bobby Jindal is getting, she says.
I don't know. I just think that when you lead, power of the tongue is an important weapon. My goodness, to be able to persuade or dissuade people into doing A or B, into following a course, is so necessary. And I just think we're pointing out that he has some lacks there.
But there have been sinister people who could give great speeches. George Wallace could give a good speech.
Yes, the content was horrific, but yeah, he was a good speaker.
And he'd have people jumping and shouting and ready to do all kinds of things.
Yeah, Hitler was a great speaker in the Germanic language, no doubt about it. That he was preaching madness and murder was, I guess, beside the point.
And as you pointed out, it wasn't a bunch of unintelligent people. This was to the most civilized country in the world at the time.
Oh, of course.
And they bought every bit of it.
They were hungry for it, and they bought every bit of it. You know what was funny? When I went to Germany in the intelligence corps, the entire time I was there, about a little more than 2 years, I never ran into a Nazi. None. They. When you ask them about Hitler or about what had happened in World War II, they took on a kind of a befuddled look, like they didn't quite understand what you meant or what your language was. So there was a disconnect. They had consciously suppressed being known as the Earth's murderers, which they were.
You know, next year, Gus, it'll be 25 years since David Duke won his Louisiana House seat, and people forget how close he came to being both a U.S. Senator and governor of Louisiana, and if not for the votes of black citizens in our state, David Duke would have been both U.S. Senator David Duke and Governor David Duke.
That would have been the ultimate insult to this state, this poor state. That would have been the ultimate insult. God knows our state has suffered horrible harm by some of its leadership. There's no terrible path that we haven't been led down or up. And that, though, would have been... It would have made us the eternal laughingstock of the whole world. It would have been like we had been able to read the future, see what Hitler did, what kind of man he was, and still voted for him.
Well, J.C. Kane has found this cut. We haven't played this in a few years. This was when Bennett Johnston was facing the challenge of David Duke and could feel the pressure mounting as Duke was gaining steam, and he ran a spot that aired in many places, including the Louisiana Radio Network. And here's the spot that Bennett Johnston ran that may have saved the race for him.
I was strident and often intolerant in my youth.
His youth. That's how David Duke dismisses his past as a Nazi sympathizer, as a Klansman. But David Duke led the Ku Klux Klan as an adult.
There is no more truly representative symbol of the white race than the fiery cross. It is our symbol, white victory.
Still burning crosses in the night, still snapping the Hitler salute, not just as a teenager, not just in his 20s, as late as last year when Duke was 39. Here's what happened if you dialed the New Orleans number for the Ku Klux Klan.
David Duke's office.
David Duke is lying about his past. Don't trust him with our future.
What do you think, Gus?
I think it's a brilliant spot. I wish I could take credit for it. It's brilliant.
I think Ray Tedley did that. You remember him, don't you?
He worked for me. I got him into advertising.
And I think he died recently. And very talented man.
He was an extremely talented man. David Duke, I only had one experience with him, and I was handling public relations for the then Casino Rouge, the gambling boat. I think it has a different name now. And I was doing a radio program, a weekly radio program, from right there on the boat. And I got their permission for me to interview David Duke, about a two-hour interview. And I found out that when he went places, he was accompanied by a bodyguard, some kind of a junior Nazis. And so I talked to the Dale Darra, the man who ran the Casino Rouge, and I'm going to need some security that night because I'm scared of his bodyguards. So he said, we'll have people there, and our security staff, and they'll be armed, and they'll be able to handle any situation. That's how frightened I was of what might happen. So here comes David Duke. He's a personable, quiet young psychopath. And I interviewed him, and there was something wrong with him. There was a wire loose in his head, and he could make the most terrible things sound so reasonable that you kind of had to shake your head to say, wait a minute, now, let me run that through my mental process again. He was certifiably crazy and very, very bright.
HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on with Gus Weil. Please be brief.
Good morning. Mr. Weil, just a quick question about our local legislature and your opinion. Do you think that the lobbyists have too much influence insofar as the budgetary allocation process goes and the success or failure of a legislative session? Thank you.
What about lobbyist influence, Gus?
Well, I want to tell you, lobbyists have tremendous influence. The greatest lobbyist in my experience is a Baton Rouge man, Randy Haney, and he does marvelous work for his clients. So, yeah, lobbyists are very powerful, and everybody has one. You can't get by now if you're going to be in public with your business, and the lobbyists are real good at persuading, really good, and I'm sure that a great deal of the time they influence what the legislature does or does not do.
Gus, last week on this show we had Bob Livingston, the former congressman who's now a lobbyist,
yes,
and a very well-paid one and a very good one. And he got a question about lobbyists having undue influence and whether or not the poor are getting the shaft. And Congressman Livingston, in response to, I think it was a question from Dan downtown, he said the poor have more lobbyists on Capitol Hill than anybody else. Do you believe that, Gus Weil? Do the poor have an inordinate number of lobbyists?
I don't know that they have more lobbyists or more powerful lobbyists. For example, the insurance industry, there'd be no way the poor could compete with them, or the gun manufacturers, there'd be no way they could compete with them, or the oil industry, there's no way the poor could compete with them. And I don't know who would represent the poor of any stature in Louisiana. I really don't.
Henry at the Country Club. Good morning, Henry. Henry, you're on the air with Gus.
Well, good afternoon, old dad. Good afternoon, Mr. Jim. How are y'all doing today?
I think it's still morning, Henry, but maybe you've had a long day. Go ahead.
Well, maybe a different time zone a little bit. Here in old dad's days in the Special Forces, of course, brings to mind our late hero, the great Fred Dent, Captain Fred Dent. And old dad, I was wondering if you could tell us where you think that the political support that he always commanded will go now that he's no longer on this earth.
All right. Well, Fred's been gone now almost 3 years.
That's a hard one, you know. I'd have to almost have a Ouija board.
Well, and Fred may have had support, but he never won an election.
So. No, he didn't. And you know, he was a good guy and a nice guy.
A great guy.
Yeah, I had an experience with Fred Dent. May I share it with you?
Sure.
I ran McKissick's campaign, and Fred ran the late Mayor Morrison's campaign. So we held equal jobs in just opposing camps.
This was 1963.
63. So when the election was over, one day my secretary tells me that Fred Dent would like to see me. And I was interested. I wondered, what in the name of goodness would he want? He was, you know, the enemy. And he told me, he said, Gus, I'm embarrassed to come to see you, but I must tell you that I need a job desperately. And listen, that's something that can happen to anybody. It has happened to me. So I said, Fred, let me think about it and see what I can do. So I went to Governor McKithen, for whom I worked, and explained him the situation. And he was a kind man, McKithen was, really kind. And he said, see if you can find him something. So I did. So anyway, Fred comes to the office to get the news. I said, Fred, before I tell you whether or not I've been successful, I must ask you one question, and only one. And I have enough confidence in you to think that you will give me an honest answer. He said, I will. I said, had Mayor Morrison won, and I, Gus Weil, had come to you all to ask for a job, would you have considered me? Would I have gotten a job? He said, absolutely not. He was honest. And I knew what the answer was. And so he became, what was he? Was he State Farm Marshal, banking?
Well, he became banking commissioner later. I don't know what he was.
We gave him a job, though, and it probably saved him at the time. But he was a nice, gentle man, and he aspired to hold high office. And as you say, never appealed to enough people.
And he was in that race in 1991 in which Edwin Edwards defeated David Duke in a runoff. Buddy Romer finished third. Clyde Holloway finished fourth. Sam Jones, the mayor of Franklin at the time, finished fifth. Ed Karst, the former mayor of Alexandria,
right,
who had had problems with his sanity, he finished sixth on a campaign to assassinate three members of the state Supreme Court. And Fred Dent finished seventh. So Fred did not fare that well.
No, but that was an awful pasting. But what a field, as you named them.
Yeah.
It was all the infamous people you could have gathered up within Louisiana. I'm amazed, as you are, that Duke didn't win.
Well, he almost did win. What about Mary Landrieu next year? She will be running against Bill Cassidy, it looks like, the congressman for Baton Rouge, and there is the prospect that Bobby Jindal might get in that race.
You know, Mary Landrieu is a nice person. I know her. I knew her father, the former mayor of New Orleans, real well. He more of my time. Mary came along a little later, and she's a nice person. She's not an outstanding legislator. She wouldn't make a list of the top 25 United States senators, but she has something that Louisiana desperately needs, seniority. She's gaining that with each term, and in the Congress, we really need a little power, and so I would be inclined to be with Mary Landrieu for that reason.
But can she win again?
Well, she starts out with every black vote. And what percent of the vote is that now, Jim?
Well, the population, the voting percentage is 32%, but unfortunately African Americans tend to vote proportionally at lower numbers than white voters, so on election day it's usually around 25 or 27%. So, but she's right, she'll get the lion's share of the minority vote.
And she'll get a big New Orleans vote where her brother is mayor.
Right.
So that starts out with a pretty healthy constituency. Not enough to be elected, but it's a good start.
Well, will Bobby Jindal get in that race? Would that make sense for him?
Well, I would think that he'll take a real good look at where at how his presidential aspirations are going and will make his judgment accordingly. For example, if it shows that he's not going to be the nominee of his party, a guy like that, yeah, he probably will run for the United States Senate.
You think so?
If it depends how his presidential aspirations are going. If he's riding high in the Republican Party for presidential nomination, no, he won't waste his name on United States Senate. He'll wait for the presidential primary. I think I can pretty well predict Jindal's future only based on what I know of him and see of him. I think that Jindal will end up possibly in the Senate. He will end up in a Republican candidate, a cabinet, one of those two places, or running some huge a corporation or think tank. So he has a bright future. None of it will be in Louisiana, however. I would stake my very life, and I'm 80 years old, so that's a precious thing. I would stake my very life that he will not spend one full year after leaving office in Louisiana, as most of our successful Washington politicians do.
Sue asked why Louisiana has veered so strongly Republican in recent decades. And we're talking very recent decades, by the way. What happened?
Well, I think that two things happened. I think it's not generally accepted or known, but we're one of the most conservative, if not the most conservative state in the nation. And many Louisianians have never accepted integration. Never. And I think that integration is associated with the Democrat Party, and that turned a lot of people a Republican. I also think that the oil industry, when it discovered Louisiana and moved by the thousands to Louisiana, it brought a huge Republican element to this state. So I think it was integration and the oil industry that created the Republican force in Louisiana.
Well, and that trend may be very difficult to change.
I think that it will be extremely difficult to change. I had the opportunity to run one campaign in Louisiana where the first Catholic was elected president, John F. Kennedy. And that was difficult, really difficult. Changing these psychological, deeply embedded trends is not an easy thing at all.
Gus Weil, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Let's talk again soon. And we'll be back with Channing Chase of Mad Men in a moment. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined now by actress Channing Chase, one of the stars of Mad Men, named as one of the top dramas of all time, number 6 from TV Guide in the list of the 60 greatest dramas in the history of television, and was named number 7 in a list of the 101 best-written TV series of all time by the Writers Guild of America. Good morning, Channing Chase.
Good morning.
It's quite a delight to talk with you, and for you as an actress, it must be quite pleasing to be a part of one of the great shows of all time.
Oh, it's my dream job.
And you have a very demanding role, don't you?
Well, when I first read the script for the pilot, I thought, I know this woman. I know who she is. She's one of these blue-blooded New Yorkers who believes that everybody exists for her benefit.
You mean there are a few people like that in New York?
Yes.
And your character is facing some challenges right now.
Yes, she is. She's slowly sinking into dementia and doesn't realize it. Back in those days, people didn't talk about dementia and Alzheimer's. It was that they talked about these older people kind of losing it.
Well, Channing, you've had a long career, and you play Dorothy Campbell on Mad Men. Have you ever had a role this rewarding?
Oh, golly, on stage I have. But the quality of the writing of this show is as if it's a prize-winning play.
What about the lead character, Mr. Draper?
John Hamm.
Yes.
Oh, he's dreamy, I tell you. I have this fantasy that's how my character ends. May I tell you my fantasy?
I think so.
it's clean. John Hamm, his character Don Draper, takes up sailing to combat his alcoholism, and he just happens to be floating by, and he picks me up, and we sail off into the sunset.
Well, that's a good dream. Now, there's nothing wrong with that one.
That's a fantasy, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly is popular with the fans.
Mm-hmm. But without that compelling lead figure in the drama, it would not be the show we know it has become.
Well, all of the main characters are so complex and interesting. John Slattery is a fascinating character. The white-haired man, we call him the Silver Fox. And my own son, Vincent Kartheiser, plays the character of Peter Campbell, and his life has become very complex.
I would imagine, yeah. Well, the 1960s were a time like no other in the history of this country. How effective has Mad Men captured that time and that place?
Oh, well, of course, both Kennedy deaths are dealt with in the series. This past sixth year, the death of Robert Kennedy is dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
I come running in and wake up my son and say, Kennedy has been murdered. It was just on the television. And he says, oh, that happened years ago, Mother. And she said, no, I just saw it. And so they're referring to Robert Kennedy's death as opposed to Jack's.
Well, it's
so that's talked about on the show. And, of course, in the late 60s was the heyday of Madison Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the title Mad Men.
Correct. A lot of sexism then. I'm sure we have it now, but my goodness, what was happening then today would not work out too well in most places.
No, it's quite true. But there are some female characters on the show that are doing very well, like Peggy Olson, played by Elizabeth Moss.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think the series is going? It's captured most of the 60s now, and the series is about the 60s. You think it has a few years left, or does it have more time than that?
Well, Matthew Weiner, who is the executive producer, intimated that next year might be the last season. Of course, it's so popular, maybe the fans will clamor for more, and who knows what will happen.
Well, Mad Men is the first and only basic cable series to win the Emmy Award for Outstanding Drama, winning it in each of its first four seasons. It is a series that I'm sure people will be watching long after it finally goes off the air. And for an actress such as you, a veteran actress, Channing Chase, this is about as good as it gets, isn't it?
Oh, I call it my dream job. There are no prima donnas on the show. And the attention to detail of the period is remarkable.
Well,
it sort of puts you right in those late 60s.
Well, we look forward to following you a few more years to come, and certainly a delight to talk with you this morning. Thank you, Channing Chase.
Well, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. And now we're joined in studio by a man closer to home who will comment about something happening farther away than Madison Avenue. Violence erupted in Cairo early today. A sit-in by supporters of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi left many dead, raising the specter of civil war. With us to talk about it is Haney Zodi, a Baton Rouge attorney who is a native of Egypt and still spends a lot of time in Egypt. What do you think, Haney, as far as what transpired today and the last week in Egypt with the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi?
That was expected anyhow.
There you go.
Okay. During the time of President Morsi, there were lots of threats to the Egyptian population in the form of, if you not go our way, we will make it a bloody environment. Right now, this morning, actually, we woke up on the news that 42 people were killed and over 200 were injured in front of the Presidential Guard house in Nasser City. Nobody knew what happened, but a few minutes ago, actually, we found out what happened. It was after Fajr prayer, where the speaker in the prayer, or the imam of the prayer, instead of giving 5-minute speech, he gave 20-minute speech. At the end of it, he made a call for jihad and directed the congregation to free Morsi and go attack the symbol of the army, which is the Presidential Guard house. And this is what happened, and other Islamists came in and start shooting at the group of people who attacked that place. That was the reason for the death of number of police officers. Actually, army officer and a police mm-hmm. officer and other individuals.
So is civil war inevitable?
No, sir. I don't believe Egypt will get into civil war. Most analysts believes that it's going to take some time and then it will be contained. If you look at the videos coming out from Cairo this morning, you would realize that this is nothing but sporadic, unorganized group of individuals and mostly of low economic standards. And the attacks that they made were somehow misguided.
What happens? Does the new government, the one installed by a military coup, does it stay on?
Well, I beg to differ. It's not a military coup. I mean, it's actually a populist demand for change. When over 22 million people went to the streets of Egypt, not in Cairo only. Mm-hmm. It's not only Tahrir Square. It's all over the country, the 28 governorates. These people demanded change. The Morsi era, the 1 year of Morsi, was a disaster. Economically, socially, there was a serious division among the population. We started hearing about Coptic group and Islamic group and so on and so forth. This country, it's not... Egypt is not the kind of country or culture that allows for such division. We've been living in harmony in thousands of years. You're not going to come today and start making these divisions. This is why the people, had an uprising against the Morsi regime. Now, if you want to talk about the Morsi regime is not Morsi, actually. Ann Patterson, the U.S. ambassador, made a statement it was in a private gathering, but that gathering, her statement became public. She had a number of offensive mm-hmm. statements she made that really, I think, in my opinion, destroyed the credibility of the United States and the country. one of the statements she made when they asked her, why are you not meeting with President Morsi and you are meeting with some other groups or some other individuals with a questionable background? She said, because I know that Egypt is being run by six people and Morsi is not one of them. She was referring to the Guidance Council for the Muslim Brotherhood.
All right. Well, he, President Morsi, vowed to die rather than abandon office, according to reports. What happens if he is killed? Do you think he will be?
I do believe the army will make sure he's not. I mean, they will do everything in their power to keep him alive. When a man like this is killed, among his followers or so-called supporters, he will become a martyr and he will become a hero. I mean, and I don't think we need this to happen. Now, you can't predict what's going to happen in the future. Right now, it's a very volatile situation, and hopefully it will be contained soon.
Well, if it isn't, at what point does the United States get involved?
The United States is already involved, thanks to Ann Patterson, who caused lots of.
Are we going to see U.S. troops in Cairo?
That will be an ill decision. I don't believe so, and I don't think the United States is going to be involved on the ground in there. Probably, politically, they will do everything they can to just contain the situation. Now, the administration and all their statements really reflects that their support the demands of the people. I mean, and that would be wise. I mean, because you don't want to lose that support. I mean, the people really initially loved the United States, but now we have really a questionable approach to the relation between Egypt and the United States.
Okay. So will there be future elections, or does this shut down elections for as far as the eye can see in Egypt?
No. The election is coming in 90 days. That the president today, this morning, issued a state that temporary president, he is the head of the Supreme Court, he issued a statement to the effect that the change or this period is not going to take more than 9 months. The smart way to do it is to have a parliament first, and after that we will have the presidential election. And that's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't just have presidential elections before having a parliament representative of the people.
When were you last in Egypt, Haney?
Actually, in November 2011. I left here on October 31st. And I personally came back after 15 days. But that was after the revolution, and I had a number of meetings with other people in there, and we've seen the grounds. And as a matter of fact, there are lots of educated Egyptians who are highly concerned about the control of the Muslim Brotherhood.
The United States is being largely silent. Is that by design?
Well, the United States was vocal through Ann Patterson, like I said. You know, I mean, she made lots of statements. She made lots of moves on the ground that offended lots of Egyptians. And really, she gave the impression that we support the Muslim Brotherhood. We want them in there. Let's not forget that 3,000 jihadists infiltrated and went inside Sinai to create the Islamic monarchy, or what they believe they can create the Islamic monarchy. And when you support these kind of acts in a country like Egypt, I don't believe that will be acceptable. Egyptian peoples are not the kind of people who will accept anything like that.
All right. Do you think the upheaval in Egypt will spill over into neighboring countries?
It's already volatile in the Middle East.
Of course.
Syria is in have lots of problems. I think there was some movements in Jordan. Of course, yeah, Lebanon had been unstable for a long time. So spilling over is already happening. Now, there is another piece of news, is that...
Well, we got a roll here, but...
For example, Tunisia. They started the same drive the Egyptian people did, which is the rebellion drive to get rid of the Brotherhood.
Okay. Well, thank you, Haney, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk with you soon. Until tomorrow for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.